My name is Philip, and I will be talking about a concept for a censorship analysis tool we came up with to make it a little bit easier to figure out what's going on with Tor in certain networks. So I will give you a little bit of an overview about what we struggled with in the past. So as it was already mentioned in a couple of presentations, Tor is being blocked in certain countries, with China, Iran, Syria, Ethiopia only being one of them. In addition, corporate firewalls, captive portals, and ISPs. So it's not just countries, you can observe this in many different layers. And usually learning about these censorship incidents is not really the big problem. So the two main sources of information are users, who somehow always find a way to basically get the word out over email, over showing up at the Tor bug tracker, or making their way to IRC or something else. So learning from users is not really a big problem. Even in heavily censoring countries, they usually find a way to somehow make developers know about what's going on. And the second is to simply look at usage statistics. So Tor has usage statistics for several countries, which basically show how many users there are in a privacy-preserving way. And it's quite interesting how much you can actually learn by just staring at a time series and trying to correlate what you see with what's going on in the real world by looking at Google News or other political things going on in the country. So it's really just a bunch of numbers, but you can actually learn a lot about that. And I have a slide about that in a second. And when you learn about that, there are different reactions to it. And sometimes it pays off to modify the Tor protocol to counter one of these censorship incidents, but this has been outsourced into a separate tool recently, which is called Office Proxy, which gives you basically a proxy on both ends, which loads so-called pluggable transport modules, which dictate how the network traffic between both endpoints is obfuscating. So regarding the time series, this is the usage statistics for Iran in 2013. And what you can see is from January until March 15th. And if I remember correctly, the elections were in June. And usually the censorship is being timed together with political events. And what you can see here is a new strategy which was based on the TLS handshake as well as on the certificates which are being used by Tor. And they deployed it a couple months earlier. So we had a small spike before March, which you can see, and then it went up for some reason again. So perhaps somebody was testing the strategies, how well they actually worked. And then it was deployed on a large scale. And you can see it dropping to, I think it was still a couple hundred users, a couple thousand users perhaps. But it was quite effective if you look at the big picture, and given that it was more than 50,000 users at some point. So by now, I hope I convinced you that having some sort of censorship analysis tool can be useful in practice. And so the motivation is that the analysis is sometimes surprisingly difficult. So it depends a lot on the network you're facing. The two typical analysis scenarios are to obtain a shell inside a censoring network. And there are different ways to do that. It doesn't have to be unlawful. It can be as simple as renting a virtual system, a VPS from a website, which I did a year ago. This is simple, and it absolutely gives you what you need. And if you don't even need a shell, you can simply look for OpenSox proxies, which are sufficient if you're trying to test for things on the application layer. An alternative would be to obtain network traces in PCAP format, perhaps. So this is less flexible. You can't really play around with it. But if you have people inside the country, volunteers who are willing to help, and perhaps even technically enough to help you, then you can get a network trace and look at it. And based on that, you can also learn how, for example, censorship during a TLS handshake can be conducted. So the problems are, I mean, this sounds fine and good, but usually there are no shells, there are no network traces, and there are not a lot of volunteers who might be able to help. So volunteers in general, yes, but perhaps not technical volunteers who can actually agree to what's going on in terms of informed consent, which is also a problem I'm going to discuss later. So that's the motivation for what we came up with. So our approach is to basically let the censorship analysis being done by the users, by unskilled users who don't really have the technical means to figure out what's going on. So the idea would be to develop a small tool which somehow reaches users. We don't really define a way how this should be done. Usually there are some out-of-band communication channels, like email is usually available, or you could get it over maybe social networks like friends. And this tool ends up in the hands of users, which then run it. The tool gathers some data, censorship analysis relevant data, and somehow sends it back to Tor, where it can be used to figure out what's going on in the network. And this comes with a couple novel technical and mostly ethical challenges, which must be balanced. So of course we can just gather all the data we can possibly think of, but that might probably not be the best case when it comes to informed consent and other ethical considerations. So the most important thing is probably to respect the privacy and security of users who volunteer to run this tool and to help shed light on censorship incidents. So in a nutshell, you could basically sum the analysis steps up in four different categories. So the main idea is to just look at the entire chain from downloading the Tor browser bundle to starting it to actually connecting to relays. And in every single one of these steps, it's possible to interfere with the process and somehow make it impossible to use Tor. This can reach from downloading the bundle from the website, but just looking at DNS requests to blackholing directory authorities, or looking at the TLS handshake, which is going on when Tor is being bootstrapped. So we basically come up with tests to look at all of these bootstrapping tests and basically raise a red flag when we see that something bad is going on. So I summarized a couple of these tests, and the first one, which is kind of an obvious one, is to just generate network traces, which can be looked at later. And this should, of course, only cover the analysis step. So we don't really want to capture any traffic which the user is generating while the analyzer is running, which is completely unrelated to what the analyzer is doing. So obviously it should really only cover the analysis, but that's feasible given the filter expressions which can be used for TCP dump. And it should also be optional. So I figured that it might be surprising to some users that something like that might be going on in the background. Of course we should always inform them, but it's kind of a dangerous thing to simply capture network traffic which somehow ends up in a report and travels across the internet. So intuitively, I would say that this should be probably an optional feature which should not be activated by default. But I guess some users might find it interesting to have something like that or helpful, so it should be present nevertheless. Another interesting thing is we kind of run into the same arms race we already have with censorship-resistant protocols. So a very eager censor might decide that it's interesting to find out where our tool is being used and hinder it from working. And there is not that much we can do against that. What we can do is we make an effort to obfuscate tests. So what we can do is we randomize the order of executed tests. We could also insert random sleep periods or modularize tests or have some parameters in them to make them look different every time. So there are a couple of things we can do, but one important thing is that this design is not undetectable. So if somebody really goes to great lengths to figure out where it is being used, then she will be successful. So it's important to understand that you can't do that much against it. And the first Tor-related step would be to probe the official website to figure out if it works. So first of all, what we do is we simply try to download the index page, and if it works, then we're fine. It's apparently not censored. But if it doesn't work, we can basically look at the DNS level and the application level, which is HTTPS. So we could simply try to issue a DNS request for the official domain and look at the A record. So inside the analyzer, we could simply hard code the IP addresses we expect. And if the answer we get, the DNS response, doesn't fit what we have hard coded into the analyzer, we could raise a red flag. And if that works, we could also look at the HTTPS layer. So the server name identifier inside TLS, which could be used to find out what's going on. The HTTP host header should be encrypted, but we could still, in certain situations, play around with it and see what's going on. But this is basically what we can automate when it comes to finding out if the website is reachable or not. So the second step would be to look at the directory authorities, which are basically a couple of computers which serve a document which comprises all the relays the network is composed of. And this is a popular choke point for sensors because it boils down to simply blacklisting a couple of boxes on the IP layer. This is really all that is necessary to block the public network. So this is the reason bridges, Tor bridges, are being used, because they are not really affected by that. But to find out what's going on in that area, we could simply try to connect to the authorities. They should reply to ICMP ACRO requests, and if we don't get any of these requests, it could already be a red flag. We could also launch trace routes to be able to narrow down where on the path towards the authorities' DPI boxes might be located. So there are quite a lot of tests which can be conducted in that regard. In the next step, if you're able to download the bundle and if you're also able to connect to the authorities, usually your client starts bootstrapping by connecting to relays. And perhaps the most popular strategy to block Tor is based on the TLS handshake. So the important thing is that depending on the application, TLS can look quite different from one instance to the next one. And Tor made an effort to look like, I think it's Firefox 8 these days, which is very difficult because browsers evolve quickly and you really have to be very careful with every single characteristic of TLS to really make it look like Firefox 8. And there are still a couple of distinguishers. I think in Iran it was the certificate, which they looked at very carefully and found out that the certificate looks different from what ordinary websites on the internet look like. So there are a couple of TLS distinguishers. When you look closely, you can distinguish Tor traffic from ordinary HTTPS traffic, which it is trying to reflect. So there are a number of things we can do. For example, you can see on the right a diagram where we could simply take the Tor's TLS client hello and send it to, for example, google.com. It doesn't really matter, to any host which speaks SSL. Assuming that it's reachable, of course, and see what happens. I mean, perhaps the TLS connection gets dropped, which could be an indicator that some fingerprint is inside the TLS client hello, but this is something we can do for relays to find out at least at which point during the TLS bootstrapping process something is happening. So usually it's the TLS client hello, but it could as well be the server hello. The same applies to bridges, but bridges are a little bit more sophisticated when it comes to censorship resistance. So they're not listed in the directory authorities in the consensus, and they have the opportunity or the ability to obfuscate network traffic using Office Proxy I mentioned earlier. So they implement these pluggable transports, which makes it possible for us to make Tor traffic look like Skype traffic or like some sort of HTTP traffic and different protocols or no protocols at all when it comes to things like the Office protocols. So the analyzer could simply have a way to make use of these pluggable transport protocols and connect to bridges. And of course, we have to somehow parameterize the analyzer to have one or two bridge addresses hard-coded inside, which could be used for the analysis. Two more tests. Of course, we're interested in a little bit more information regarding where the user is. So simply putting the IP address inside the report is probably not that smart. We want at least some degree of anonymity. And censorship is also not uniform across the country. So if you are able to expose some sort of traffic tampering, then it's probably not very smart to infer that this strategy is being used all over the country. So this is the reason why we want to learn about the ISP, for example, because it can vary depending on the ISP, and also about the autonomous system number, or perhaps figure out if the user is behind a captive portal, which can be surprisingly difficult, but we can check for website redirects, which always point towards the same website, or check for HTTP proxies, because this is likely a source for plenty of false positives. People scream censorship, but all that is happening is some sort of very restrictive corporate firewall. And another important thing is finally to anonymize reports. And you have to distinguish between the actual report, which is basically just a document which holds different information, and the submission of the report. And the document itself can be anonymized. We have full control about everything which ends up in the report. We could simply drop all location information, and with location I mean IP address related information, like network traces, completely drop them, IP addresses, autonomous system numbers, WHOIS records, as well as trace routes. So as all of that is removed, we don't really have any hint about where the report was generated. But the difficult part is to submit the report, because the very tool you usually use to submit or to send something in an anonymous fashion is supposed to be blocked, so we cannot really make use of it. But there are a couple of ways what we can do, I will present in a minute. And another important thing is to think about the users, because our tool is supposed to be run by non-technical users. So it's very important that it's as easy to use as possible, which means that it should be a click-and-go executable. You're not supposed to compile your source code or configure it or do something else. So it should really be something which pretty much works out of the box. And of course, it should be it should also have a way to delete reports after submission. And this doesn't work unconditionally. I mean, it depends on your threat model. So if somebody is doing file system forensics, then you will run into problems. But if your threat model is more or less decent, then this is good enough if a final report is simply deleted. And another thing is informed consent. So users should be, even if they're not technical, should have some idea of what's going on. The analyzer should inform them about the process, what the analyzer is doing, and also very important, they should have the ability to abort at any point in time. So it should not like, oh, by the way, we're going to do these network measurements and the report is already submitted and there is nothing you can do about it. So this is probably not really the way to go in this case. So it should be made clear what is going on, and at any case, it should be possible to stop it. So to not bring the user into any issues. And one problem we still have so far is, or we would have, is there isn't really any usage diversity. So far, the entire idea of the analyzer is to assist in censorship circumvention, which means that if somebody comes up with a way to find these instances on users' computers by just looking at network traffic, you are kind of labeled as being a suspicious person automatically because, yeah, you run this analyzer, and the only point of it is to assist in censorship circumvention. So I think it's important to have another use case, which means that the analyzer should be able to give you recommendations to perhaps make your Tor work again. And this could be a simple decision tree. So we find out that the website might not be reachable, we find out that the mirrors of the website are also not reachable, but perhaps we can recommend something like GetTor, which is a program which gives you a copy of the software over email. So using such a decision tree, we can issue recommendations for the user and tell them why the analyzer thinks the program doesn't work, and give recommendations what to do against it. And this creates usage diversity. There is no longer only one reason to run the tool, there is now a second reason, to simply learn about what's going on in your network and what you can do against it. So if somebody catches you with that you run the tool, you could always say, I was never interested in assisting in censorship circumvention, I was only interested in finding out why my Tor wouldn't bootstrap and what I can do against it. But I have no connection to any censorship circumvention whatsoever. So there are probably more things. So this is one we thought about, that it could just give you recommendations, but there are probably even more use cases which could perhaps make the situation even less dangerous. Finally, a little bit more words regarding report submission. So what we have is a report, as I already said, in YAML-like data, and we kind of want to send it back to Tor in some way. And we don't really define one way to do that, because this one way could always be blocked in some way. So we kind of left this open. So the users end up with the report, and they could, for example, use email. I mean, email is something which is usually always available. You could fire up or create a random Gmail account, which still makes you subject to NSA surveillance, but at least it might work in your country. Or you could use instant messengers, which is also a way to do that. So, or you could just, maybe there would be another way to just issue an HTTP post request to submit it somewhere. So we kind of leave this open. Another way would be to hard code an OpenPGP key, which is used to encrypt the email. And of course, encryption comes at the cost of key management, but I think it might be worth doing that just to give users the opportunity to encrypt reports. So, yeah, it boils down to submission is still a hard problem, but the report itself can be anonymized, even though some useful data is lost in the process. When it comes to the actual implementation, there is no need to reinvent the wheel. So we plan on basing the implementation on UNI, which was presented last year at FOCI. And it's a modular framework which is under heavy development, but quite useful already, which can be used to detect censorship and to measure network interference. So what we do is we just write a bunch of tests. So UNI allows you to write your own tests, which then get executed. So it's quite similar to unit testing as it is being done in Python. So the end goal would be to just have a couple of unit tests and bundle the entire tool inside a click and go executable, which then sort of makes it its way towards the user. So this is what a test looks like. It's just a couple of Python lines which look for DNS-based censorship. So you can see, I hope it's readable sort of, we have the expected A records for the domain torproject.org. And when UNI starts, it automatically executes the test domains function, which then iterates over the domains we specified at the top. And if they don't match the expected DNS responses, then we can raise a red flag. And we can use different DNS servers for this. Here we have the Google one hard-coded in it, but it's not a problem to use different ones. So this is basically what all the tests we came up with would look like when it comes to Python source code. And yeah, once again, I have to repeat that the analyzer we came up with is not undetectable. So this is important to understand, that if somebody goes to really great lengths to detect it, odds are that you will be able to do that. So if you have a very strong threat model and if you're scared to death about that happening, then you should simply not use the tool. And there are a couple of additional features which would be really interesting to have but are far outside the scope of what we've done. So one would be to automatically find out what DPI fingerprints are being used for censorship. So usually people assume that those are simple regular expressions, but it looks like that's not always the case. So in Ethiopia, we have seen basically a context-sensitive language, which is being used for that. So they were looking at lengths field inside the TLS handshake to jump to, I think, TLS options and look at a couple of sent options. So it would be really great to have an algorithm, which probably boils down to some client-server architecture, which is able to probe DPI boxes in a systematic manner and infer what DPI fingerprints are being used. So this is a really hard problem, and I don't think we're anywhere close to anything usable in practice for that, but it would obviously be of very great value to have that. And if we would have that, we could even feed it into tools like format transforming encryption, which is basically a way to take arbitrary data and format it in accordance with pre-specified regular expressions. So this is something which could actually be useful in practice. Another point is that it would be great to be able to look at DPI boxes and find out where they are coming from. This could boil down to simply doing a couple of trace routes and perhaps even port scan the middle boxes on the path and see if they have some exposed management interfaces as it was done with Blue Coat. But sometimes, yeah, it doesn't work that well. So some of these DPI boxes don't even have an IP address and are not even exposed to the public internet. So if we have bad luck, it's almost impossible to learn anything about these DPI boxes. But sometimes it is possible, and I think it would be really handy to have a way to make use of this information somehow. Okay, that brings me to the end. So my contact information, and thanks for listening, and I would be looking forward to any questions. Yes.
So you mentioned earlier that you could kind of say that, oh, I just want my chore to work. But isn't chore synonymous with self-mention? Isn't chore synonymous with self-mention? So you wanting your chore to work is kind of the same thing.
That is true, but you have to distinguish between actively helping Tor to make it better and just figuring out what's going on. So I feel like there is still a little bit of a difference, that you actively do something to make the situation better, to basically let the tool analyze your network, or simply in your nutshell, in your isolated bubble, figure out what's going on, if that answers the question. Yes.
Wouldn't a better tool to integrate with been like XAnalyzer? Because there you're saying, oh no, I'm just analyzing my network to see what my throughput is and how good my DNS contacts are. They seem to do a lot of the same kind of things. I believe that's in Java instead of...
XAnalyzer. What was the name?
Talk to the person sitting in front of you.
Okay. Analyzer. Okay, I know that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm just saying there's another platform.
Okay.
Different language, but it would be.
I think it does provide better power, like your frame.
Yes, but yeah, I'm saying that would be a better. Power. Mm-hmm. And it does many of the same things. But.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But we thought quite a bit about censorship stuff in Netalyzer, and have been a little reluctant because the informed. How do we don't want general users to be conducting such measurement without informed consent. And so that's hard. And then once you have it, then you lose some of that cover. So, hey, look, you said.
Right, you must have clicked that button that said I was informed, and therefore. Yes, there are always issues, but I'm just saying.
So.
It's the cover that came to my mind. That would be much more general.
I think when the UNI people started the project, they also looked at Netalyzer and a couple of other different projects, and they came up with a reason why, or with a couple of reasons why it would be worth starting a new project. I can't really give you the reasons right now because I'm not that involved in UNI, but they have reasons for that.
I mean, one good one, and serious problems with Netalyzer in its current form is Java. Mm-hmm. People should not be running. We have a follow-on project called Fathom, which enables a JavaScript API for measurement.
Mm-hmm.
The problem there is getting the low, if you want low-level detailed measurement, that's harder to do.
Yeah. Yes?
Are you able to determine how much cost is associated with this analyzer tool?
Cost in terms of? So I'm afraid the only code there is that right now. And yeah, regarding cost, I don't think it's that costly. I mean, the main code base is UNI. What we have is just a couple of tests. And UNI is really just a collection of Python tools. So computational cost should be rather low. And yeah, network cost should also be rather low because we don't really want to flood the network with traffic. We try to stay under the radar to some extent. So we don't have an implementation of it yet, but I would say that the cost is in both cases not extensive.
So you mean as an end user, I can expect using this tool without my network to be flooded.
Yeah, that would be the goals.
Because that's a big incentive for
sure. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So organizations that aren't nation states, like you mentioned corporate firewalls and Catholic portals. Can you say more about what kind of organizations are blocking Tor and how they're doing it and everything that aren't nation states?
I don't have that much information about it, but I think that a couple of commercial DPI boxes basically have a checkbox where you click on, circumvention tools or whatever they label it. So I can't really give you any names, but I'm just aware that it's there.
It's the same names you read about in countries. So the same stuff that Syria uses, Boeing uses. So the adversaries overlap more than we would like.
Yes.
I don't know if this was in your motivation slide, but
reason we wanted to use people was it's easier to get more numbers that way. So do you think maybe you should push towards getting dumb boxes, and then you don't have that issue of, you know, informed consent and all that other stuff because you're not really impacting anyone? Like you device a virtual machine in that country and try to do tests like that.
So instead of using users to just let it run on virtual boxes or something?
Yeah.
I mean, we already have that opportunity if we have control over the virtual boxes, basically. So yeah, as you said, I think the main reason or the main good thing about it would be to have more coverage, to be able to expose incidents we couldn't have exposed without it, basically.
Also, if you have one centralized computer doing all the measurements, and they notice that that's the one doing all the measurements, they can start treating it differently.
Yeah, I don't know, centralized. Like media plot.
They're going to stop measuring that application.
Pardon?
Thanks.